Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning! Good morning! I'm here. That welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown. You are listening to The Brown Briefly. It's Tuesday, May 18th, 2021, and I'm calling this the Dandelion Edition. Just look out your windows and around and you might see why. This morning, we have the four briefly gathered via the magic of Zoom to discuss local, state, and national news and nonsense. Welcome, Lynn Kerrigan, filling in as our sound engineer at the helm in Vachon, Voice of Vachon headquarters.
She's
our sound engineer for us this morning. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, good morning.
We also have us with us this morning via the magic of Zoom, Kevin Jones and Bruce Hallman. I'm Gail Kellner, and I'm your host for this week's program. Well, everything is breaking into bloom around us here on Vachon. The distant sound of neighborhood lawnmowers is a sure sign of spring as the return of the swallows and the bloom of the dandelions. Dandelions originally were brought here as ornamentals, but they're considered weeds by many a frustrated gardener. So I was happy to learn recently that I have good reason to leave them alone, even encourage them taking over my yard. If you care about bees, you might want to rethink mowing them down too. As it turns out, they're an early source of food for bees in the spring. And so I'm calling this the Brown Briefly, the Dandelion Edition. And at the end of the show, I will share another reason to rethink our relationship with the lowly dandelion. Okay.
I can jump in here.
Yes,
it's very
absolutely
interesting. When you read the newspapers on Vachon from the 1910s and 1920s, they advertised a new ornamental flower called the Dent de Leon, the Tooth of the Lion. And that's where dandelion comes from. So they were sold as ornamental flowers for your garden, if you can imagine.
Ornamentals.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Hey, I'll have to say, you know, the bees and the hummingbirds and the butterflies and all that are important visitors to our backyard deck. And we just yesterday, Susie said, we need to go buy that dark blue shrub that we see. It's along out on the Burton Peninsula. And I believe it's Caryopteris dark night is the one that we saw. And we took a picture and we stopped by and the homeowner was there. She said, take a little snippet up to Kathy's corner. Because all the pollinators are just, man, that's where they go. And so we now have two in pots that are going to go into the yard somewhere. They are deer proof. They love awful soil. They don't need water. It's like a perfect Vachon plant for our garden anyway.
They sound a lot like dandelions.
They do,
but
yeah.
Larger. Absolutely. I've seen them. They're wonderful. Yeah, they're just a buzz with the pollinators. Yes, yes, yes. Well, thank you for your additions. Yeah, I love that.
Kathy still has like a dozen in pots up there, so you know, go get them.
What are they, Kevin? What's the name of that plant?
Caryopteris dark night is the one that we looked up. But if you go in, and I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, Susie pointed out that all of the native Latin speakers communities had expired by the time Latin sort of had its resurgence. And so there's all this debate about how to pronounce something with no community who was actually speaking the language, right, that we can go back to validate, no tapes, right, from ancient Rome. But I call it Caryopteris dark night. And if you use those words, they'll direct you to the right place.
All right, thank you.
That's interesting about Latin. Yes, it's known as a dead language because of that. There's no living speakers of it. But of course, it's the base of much of the Romantic languages. And through them, we have many English words that are Latin and, of course, used in science. Thanks for that. Bruce, do you have anything to add to that thought?
No, it's just, you know, it's fascinating when you think about Native American languages that are being lost and the rate at which they're being lost, mm-hmm. and the attempts to reestablish Native languages. There was a fascinating article in New York about a Native language in Maine, I believe, that was recorded in the 1940s and 50s, 30s, beginning in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. By an ethnologist who copyrighted the language. And so basically this dead white guy owns this Indian language. And of course the tribe is struggling to regain control over its own language. And there's very few original speakers left, but they've got education programs. Same thing's happening here with the Puyallup reservation and Tlaloc Seed, which is the Puyallup version of Lushoot Seed and Coast Salish. So there were different dialects all up and down the sound, much like any language, it develops little regional kinds of pronunciations. But it's that interesting thing of how Latin was resurrected and becomes the basis for much of education. And up through the middle of the 20th century, it was sort of a requirement in most educational institutions. And whether or not that will happen with Native languages, it's just kind of an interesting thing to think about.
Bruce, yeah. I read that article and was fascinated at the idea that the business of this old dead white guy that had copyrighted the language was because he wrote a book about all of right. the discoveries that he made about the language. And apparently in American copyright law, if you write a book about something that's copyrighted, you own that material. So it got all into these very arcane property, intellectual property laws. And, you know, America is nothing if not the land of warped lawsuits. So I hope the Puyallups can avoid the same fate.
Exactly. I often think about, should I, because my brief history of Vashon is copyrighted. Does that mean I own Vashon history?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, I figured you must. You're everywhere. Nobody can speak your words.
Yeah, right.
That's how you guard our galaxy.
That's right. And Bruce, let me plumb the depths a little more. Bruce Hallman here with us this morning is a historian, fondly known here at the Briefly as the Guardian of the Galaxy. You're also president of the Vashon Maury Island Historical Museum's board. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you tell us, how do you have time for it all?
Late nights and little sleep, right?
Guarding the galaxy alone. I don't know how you fit in anything else, but I'm proud to have you here. Can you tell us about this Histories and Mysteries program coming up, the benefit for the museum?
Sure. It's this Saturday evening at 7 p.m. It's Histories and Mysteries, Funding Our Future. In this time of COVID, it's been very difficult for nonprofit organizations to hold traditional kinds of fundraisers or events or auctions or any of that kind of thing. And so we're using the model that other nonprofits on the island have used during this time of COVID, and we're doing a virtual online Zoom kind of fundraiser. And it's really focused around what the museum does on the island, which is essentially collect and provide a mechanism and a place for people to tell their stories. The museum doesn't tell the stories, but we bring in guest curators and we bring in community members and organize exhibits like In and Out and Joy and Heartache and the upcoming exhibit that'll open over the summer called Natural Wonder, about the natural history of Vashon, working with the Vashon Nature Center. And so this is a fundraiser, but it doesn't cost anything to come, and you don't even have to donate. But you will learn about the museum, and you just go to the VashonHeritageMuseum.org, all one word, VashonHeritageMuseum.org. That's the museum website, and there's a place to register. And it's like any kind of Zoom webinar. You just register, and they'll send you a link. And at 7 p.m., you'll be entertained for 45, 50 minutes with some little known facts about Vashon history with some songs by Enjoy, Martha and Kevin Joyce, and also hear from some of the people who have worked with the museum to put together exhibits and to work with the education programs that we do. So please turn out, learn about the museum, and if you're able, donate a little bit of money. It all helps, right?
Great.
So thank you, Gail.
Yeah, thank you. Would any of the Briefleys like to talk for a few minutes about the Give Big event? Voice of Vashon was a part of that event, and I'd love to hear. I was absent on that particular week.
We had a really interesting presentation, I think, by our three event producers. You know, there were two people transmitting from Mukai Garden over an iPhone connection, so it was a little bit hard to hear sometime, but you got to see the poems that were up behind the speakers, which was nice. And we had a very incredibly detailed presentation by someone from the food bank, which I was amazed at, all of their programs that they've been upgrading to given the pandemic, you know, a lot of home delivery and other types of services that they've done. And I guess what I'd like to hear is kind of how people were able to raise money, if anybody has heard anything about, you know, the numbers from Give Big. I've not.
Yeah, it was very successful. I mean, the museum raised about almost $10,000. Land Trust raised over $30,000. Vashon Arts Center raised, I think, 15. Mukai raised about 6,000. So, wow. And Food Bank did very, very well. Vashon Household. I mean, so, and you can actually go into the Give Big Washington website, and you can see the results for each organization. You just click on the organization, and you can see the total amounts of donations. So it's a very important part of nonprofits' financial year. And Give Big is one of those events that tries to sort of focus attention on nonprofits. And Voice of Vashon is essential to it. Voice of Vashon takes 2 days of programming, and like we did on the Brown Briefly last week. I mean, basically every 15 minutes or so, a nonprofit is featured and they get to tell you about what they're doing and the work they're doing. And so it's a very good way to get to know the island and get to know what's going on the island and get to know the diversity. I mean, there's over 140 nonprofits on Vashon.
Really? So it's one of the reasons that Vashon's so great to live at. I just wanted to mention that our third group that was on the Brown Briefly was Sisterhood, which is a nonprofit to empower young women and to mentor them with, you know, older women working with middle school and high school groups, and they are working to start camps and to start other outreach programs. I was really impressed, since I know how much the Girl Scouts meant to me. Kevin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just wanted to follow up, Lynn. It was Emily Scott from the Food Bank who came and talked. And you sort of, any one of these organizations, you start to understand the scope of what they do, and there's way more under the hood, if you will. And Emily verified that, not only food, but services, connecting folks on the island with a variety of services. And for anybody like me who always brought my grocery bags up when I went grocery shopping and put my groceries in them, now in COVID, you can't do that. But guess what? She said the food bank is accepting donations of grocery bags.
And so clean
bring
bags.
Them to the food bank up on Sunset Ridge. Yeah. And
Bruce,
put some food in them if you like.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, if you want to see a very magnificent way of responding to COVID, go up to Sunrise Ridge to where the food bank distributes food. And an island artist, and her name escapes me right now, but she developed this beautiful mandala that they put on the pavement, and each spot on the mandala is 6 feet apart. So when you're waiting at the food bank to pick up food, you stand at a spot on the Mandela and then you work your way up and everybody's socially distanced 6 feet apart. And it's just one of those things to me that makes Vashon so special, where it's taking a nonprofit like the food bank that has a very utilitarian function and yet infusing it with art. And not many places do that. Art becomes a living part of even something as utilitarian as the food bank. And that to me is very, very special.
That is way cool. But I have to correct your pronunciation. Is it not Mandela rather than President Nelson Mandela from South Africa? Sorry, a little knife in the ribs there, Bruce.
Okay. Well, I want to welcome again to Kevin Jones, Vashon's own superhero of activism at the helm of Indivisible Vashon. What have you and your merry gang of activists been paying attention to this week, Kevin?
We're still seeing so many great legislative accomplishments coming out of the U.S. House and going over to the U.S. Senate to sit on a desk and wait to move forward. So the filibuster is still clearly in our sights. We did have a chance. Senator Cantwell joined the Indivisible Washington for a town hall on Zoom, a fairly rare event. The senator was in very good form, addressed a lot of issues. Relative to the filibuster, she said she supports changing back to a talking filibuster, which requires somebody to actually be present in order to extend the debate on a piece of legislation, at the end of which time they would go to a vote where a majority rules for typical legislative matters. So we liked to hear that. We did ask Senator Cantwell about kind of her time frame, because we know that, the 2022 election historically will result in a loss of either the House or the Senate or both for Democratic control. And unfortunately, the senator said she didn't really have an idea about that. So we need to continue to communicate with both of our senators about, they need to understand the magnitude of the agenda, the block, the roadblock that the filibuster creates, the timeline that we have to act, and to encourage them to move and do so soon. So that's kind of where our focus has been.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Kevin. Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's having the particularly the legislation around voting rights is so important. It's at the base of anything else we want to do going forward. And so, if that's curtailed by Republicans around the country, I think we're in trouble if we let that go forward. So thank you for your work on that. I was interested paying attention, reading a little bit in the Seattle Times this week about our state legislature, and I've just been so proud to be a Washingtonian lately. Jay Inslee has come out with just some, from a progressive standpoint, some wonderful, wonderful things. Besides the cap and trade agreements, but also maybe one of you can talk about his stance on electric cars. There was going to be a mandate that by 2030, all new cars had to be, am I right about this? It was a very detailed little nuanced legislation, and he ended up not addressing or vetoing that aspect of it, from what I understand. Kevin, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
That legislation has gone through a couple of different twists and turns through the legislative process. Cultura is the name of the organization that was behind it, and their objective was that no fossil fuel powered vehicle could be licensed in the state of Washington after the year 2030. And that means all the cars that were here already, no problem, right? But if you try to get a license, go out and get a license for a vehicle, either one that you wanted to buy or one that you wanted to bring into the state, it had to be electric, or it had to be hydrogen, or it had to be some other form of fuel besides fossil fuels. And the bill, it was 2030. No, it was the bill. I can't remember the bill number. but in the first chamber, it was amended so that the mandate became a goal. And at that point, we were really struggling to decide whether to support the legislation. The sponsor said it will send a message across the country. And our worry was it'll send a message across the country that people aren't going to take it seriously as a goal. The provision that prompted Governor Inslee's veto was a condition in the bill. And I was going to have to go back and look at the details. It was tied somehow to transportation, a transportation budget issue, and a provision that Senator Hobbs, who sits on the Senate Transportation Committee, he amended, proposed an amendment, which was accepted into the bill. And that caused the governor to veto that portion of it because he didn't like to create this relationship between clean cars and transportation budget. And I'd have to get the details. But the goal, I believe, still is in law. But it is, unfortunately, only a goal.
I'm proud we're moving in that direction. And I do hope, as you do, that we move more towards things that have a bit more teeth in them. We don't have the kind of time to just have a goal. We have to actually have an action that follows it. But I am glad to see the kind of things coming through the legislature, in the state legislature. Lynn?
Yeah, I was just going to say I've been following the police and gun violence sort of laws that have been being signed now by Inslee this week. Last week I was prepared to name them all off, but I researched and didn't bring with me all of the points that Inslee is signing into law this week from bills that I think his name is Representative Johnson, was maybe Senator Johnson, Kevin, do you know the guy that's been sponsoring a lot of those bills? But I know they did some things like banning chokeholds and those neck restraints, you know, making sure that IDs are visible on every policeman's uniform, looking at setting up review boards around uses of force and making those policies way more transparent to people, making it easier for families of injured or killed loved ones are able to get information quicker, and that, you know, they are included in the release of information. So there's some good things happening right now. I'm really impressed with Washington State too.
Yeah, I am too. Thank you for that, Lynn. Well, and that voice we just heard is former Georgia Peach, poet, provocateur, musician, feminist, fighter for justice, and added to her repertoire of skills, now sound engineer. So moving to a little lighter side of things, Lynn, there's been a lot of talk of UFOs in the news in the last few weeks. And what do you make of all of that? Briefly, let's weigh in on the unidentified flying objects. Are they more than drones?
I have to tell you, I'm so excited about this that I'm going to have to restrain myself as we talk so that I don't come across as an incredible source. So, you know, here's what I've been paying attention to is that I missed this 2 years ago when the New York Times had a big article talking about some of their previously classified clips and information was being released out of the Air Force and the government. So on December 16th, 2017, the New York Times published an article about that, which I missed completely. But in the New Yorker this week, which is the May 10th edition, they published the UFO papers, which is a sort of summary of all this recent flare-up and activity, basically saying that the Air Force has kind of gotten tired of trying to pretend that none of this is true and that it's all been classified and the Air Force is maybe sitting on it. You know, there have been television shows, Project Blue Book has been on the air. And basically in this article, the UFO papers, they went through a number of reported UFO sightings and incidents, and basically said that when the Air Force decided to declassify a lot of this, they have now admitted that about 20% of things that have been reported to them are not explainable by any other method. They're not weather balloons or stars or swamp gas or any of the things that they've been called a hoax, you know, all of that, that about 20% of their reports are now being reclassified as unidentifiable aerial phenomenon. So they are saving face by no longer calling them UFOs, but now they are unidentifiable aerial phenomenons. And they're saying there's just too much information out there. In other words, they don't control all the sources or the information anymore. There's too many clips that are floating around of sightings. And this includes the 1947 sighting over Mount Rainier. This was called out as one of the first sightings that they find was credible. And after that came the Maury Island incident 3 days later. Supposedly, two fishermen out on harbor patrol saw UFOs in the sky, one of which was said to have exploded over our Salish Sea and rained down little bits of white, what looked like paper, but were said to be very lightweight metal, and chunks of something that was said to have killed one of the men and injured the dog. That was later reported to be a hoax, but in reading about all this, the guy said he was kind of pressured into saying it was a hoax. And then came Roswell. So all of this was said to be because of the puzzled UFO people or aliens or whatever they are, ETs out there that were checking out what we had done in World War II, you know, when we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that it created apparently a very visible rupture in the force of the universe. And throughout the 40s and the 50s, there were a lot of sightings all over the world, which have now been kind of declassified and is said to be documentable sources of this. And they're saying it's not if they're here, they're here. It's a matter of where they are and who do they look like. So this just tickles me to death. And I'm curious whether any of y'all have read about this, what you think about it. I am delighted to know we're not the most intelligent people in the universe. So that's my contribution to this. What do y'all think?
Well, I suspected that. I've suspected that for a long time, that we're not the most intelligent. Bruce, go ahead.
If you're interested in the Maury Island incident, the museum had a talk by Cyrus Anderson. It's online at the museum website, and you can watch it. It's about a 50-minute presentation. Cyrus has done a lot of research on the Maury Island incident. He went through all the released material from the Blue Books, Project Blue Book, and you know, one of the interesting things to come out of it was the struggle between the Air Force and the FBI over who would investigate these sort of events and reports. And Maury Island incident's most probably a hoax, but it's, you know, again, you know, like everything, it becomes mythological. The men in black showed up to interview people and then took some of the material with them, and then their airplane crashed on the way back to Arizona. And so, you know, conspiracy theories just sort of like spring up. But if you tune in this week, this Saturday at 7 for the Histories and Mysteries, one of them is about the crashed flying saucer on Vashon Island.
Yes.
At the Vashon Island Airport. So we do have an actual flying saucer on Vashon. So one of those little mysteries.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Hey, I just wanted to mention that anybody who wants to dig in deeper and go beyond the Vashon scene, I don't know if they're still doing it, but we, Susie and I and some good friends attended the McMiniman's McMinnville Hotel UFO Festival.
Ooh, in Oregon?
And in McMinnville, Oregon,
yeah.
Which for UFO aficionados or UAP aficionados now, there was a quite famous sighting with photographs and all in McMinnville. And so, yeah, we had a chance to go, and there were ufologists and specialists and people talking about abductions and implants and et cetera, you know, where they put a tracking device into your body and return you back to Earth. They had a parade. They had a pet parade, so you could dress up your pet like an alien. And that was a lot of fun. Our friends and I, we were sort of, you know, joking around about it outside and within earshot of a couple locals. And I can tell you, one woman gave me the look that could wilt a rose and like, you have to, this is not fooling around. It's like very serious. So, yes, you can find some definite believers and experts at check up the McMinnville, McMinimans, and see if they are still going for the UFO festival.
Ooh, I love knowing about that. I may have to look that up. I ran into a ufologist. I will say that because he had a shirt on that said it at a conference that I was at for something completely unrelated. And this guy started showing me clips on his phone of the sighting over the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And that was actually shown on Ancient Aliens recently itself as one of the sightings that they can't explain. But I thought a fight was going to break out between this guy that was talking about just what he knew about and was showing pictures of, and this other scientist that was sitting on the other side of me that just, you know, wanted to debunk it and was really outraged that this man was talking about it no matter what. You know, he was not going to be shut down, and I had to get up and move. I couldn't sit between the two of them. They were so irate, and I was just curious. Yeah, Gail.
Well, I'm going to move us along a little bit. I this morning, there was some identifiable flying objects that greeted me this morning when I opened my door, and they were fledgling stellar jays, two a pair, and they were just as bright and clumsy and cute as you can imagine little birds can be. So I was interested. I want to call them blue jays because they're the brightest blue bird that we have around here. But I think technically they're considered stellar jays. So one of my sister tells me anyway. Any wild life sightings, identifiable flying objects that any of you have seen this last week? Any new birds at our newly minted bird feeders, or cleaned feeders, as I should perhaps? I know. Go ahead, Bruce, and then Kevin.
Yeah, the ospreys are back in Tramp Harbor in force, and always interesting to watch the interplay between ospreys, eagles, and crows. The ospreys, who are the workforce, if you will, catch most of the fish, and then the eagles try and take them away from them, and the crows try and harass the eagles because the eagles rob the crow's nest. And so it's been very interesting, but also fascinating this year, many more than usual Canada geese staying resident on Vashon rather than just transiting through, and whether that's, I assume, global warming sort of associated, but yeah, it's really noticeable as you walk the island, as you go through the Island Center Forest. There's a resident pair that have taken up at the Mukai Farm and Garden. There's Canada geese at Ellisport and KVI Beach virtually every day, and that's unusual. So some things are happening.
You know, Bruce, I was down walking at KVI Beach the other day, and there were two pairs of Canadian geese that flew fairly low overhead out toward the water. And I was so amused that I didn't realize this before, but they appeared to have their own little pair calls as they flew. So one was quite benign. It was just this sort of But one, I'm telling you, had this elaborate whining going on. One was going, and the other going,
We might have to edit this out. So,
well, I call it whining.
Be
it
careful,
did come out something like something else, but it was not that.
You know, sound, it was whining. Sound engineer, sound effects all in one. That's awesome.
But okay. I'd never paid attention to that.
Go ahead,
Gail, I was going to mention that we're spending a lot more time around the house now with this unseasonably sunny and dry and warm weather, and part of that is to kind of go back out into the barn and all the stuff that sort of just finds its way to the barn is now getting organized, and some of it is going to disappear.
Can you come to my house next? I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
This is just a lead-in. This is just the lead-in to a story. But we can talk later. And so there's some nests that appear in the barn, and you never know. You come across a nest, and it's like, oh, is that like an active nest, or is that like a nest of years past? And it turns out that both a robin and a junco have taken up residence in our barn. And I see my internet connection said it's unstable, so it must have dropped. But anyway, a robin and a junco. And normally, the robins are out, in the field, looking for worms. And they don't usually, I don't notice that much, and they don't seem to pay attention to me. But now that I've been spending time in the barn, when I'm out like nearby the barn, this robin comes along and like it'll land on the fence and sit there and look at me like intently. And I'm thinking, you must belong to the nest. The junco is a little different. They do this tick, 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 tick noise when you get near their nest. And so I'm out there and I hear that. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to get out of your way soon. And eventually they get brave enough. They come in and actually go to the nest, when you're inside the barn. So it's been great to interact with these animals and try to give them their space, even though we're trying to clean up our barn.
Thank you for that. Well, one thing I wanted to mention before we go is that on this Thursday, May 20th at 7 p.m., there's going to be a talk about called Living Waters and Salmon Flash Talks. This is sponsored by the Vashon Center for the Arts, and it's a Zoom situation, and with a suggested donation of $10, and there's a series of speakers that will be talking about salmon and their role in the Salish Sea. And one of the things that I picked up in my reading this last week was something that the King County has been up to, and they've been going around identifying culverts that are blocked or in some way inhibit salmon from going up them to spawn. And they have identified, I think it was in the range of several hundred or thousand different ones, and quite a large handful of them are on Vashon Island. So including ones in my neighborhood here, which I've been thinking for years, boy, it wouldn't be that hard to take a culvert and make it a little bit more accessible, because we have many year-round streams on Vashon that are not very long. They're little springs, really, they're not quite as big as Judd Creek or Fern Creek or any of those larger, or Fern Cove, nothing quite as large as those. We only have, two, what you would consider year-round large streams, but we have lots of little springs that run down to the sound, and they have been calling them the arteries of the Salish Sea. So it's like these tiny little streams, but they play an important part in the health for the salmon. So that's something I think we can look forward to in the coming months, years, seeing those the flows cleaned out so they don't expel salmon, seeing them unblocked so that salmon can get up them. Bruce, you have a thought about that?
That talk is part of a series of talks that are sponsored jointly by the Vashon Center for the Arts, Vashon Nature Center, and the Heritage Museum exhibit that will open over the summer called Natural Wonder, an Island Shaped by Water. And it's looking at the role of water on Vashon, but also in the whole sort of natural history of Vashon. What's interesting about this talk is that it will be followed in the fall with a talk by fishermen, so commercial Indian and sports fishermen who actually catch the salmon and who have been concerned with preserving salmon. The other thing that's going to be fascinating is on May 10th, the museum will open an outdoor installation called the Whale People. It's a collaboration with the Lummi tribe and the Puyallup tribe. It's an it's a multimedia installation where you walk into this sort of theater in the round and you're underwater swimming with the whales. There'll be a 10-foot orca pole in the center of the space. It's a 30-foot sort of display space. And the pole was carved by the Lummi Carving Group, who are also carving a 24-foot orca pole that's going to be what they're calling the Red Road this summer, that will make its way from Lummi Island back to Washington, D.C. And on May 9th and 10th, it'll be at the Heritage Museum as part of the opening of this Whale People exhibit. So look for a lot of things over the summer and into the fall about the role of salmon, the role of orcas, and the role of water on Vashon Island.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. We're getting near the end, so I have a couple of things. One, I promised our listeners to follow up on why it's called the Dandelion Edition. On a note of good news, there is a major tire company in Germany who's working with the University of Aachen to produce dandelion rubber tires. Is actually something, Bruce, you might like to weigh into this. During the Second World War, the major powers of the United States, UK, and the Soviet Union, as well as the German, were all cultivating dandelions for rubber manufacturing because it just wasn't enough. They weren't able to get the amount of rubber they wanted out of Brazil, the traditional supply that way. And then, you know, after the war, we went back to, you know, rubber in combination with petrochemical tires, synthetic tires. But this company is going back and looks like dandelions are on the rise. They can be used as, you know, wonderful because they cut down on micro pollutions, deforestation, and the use of petrochemicals. So they can grow practically anywhere. They need little accommodation. They'll grow on top of, you know, toxic waste or old industrial sites or polluted land. They don't need a lot of water. As anyone who's ever tried to get rid of a dandelion knows, if they're tall and you cut them, they just grow back short. if you clip them off short, they'll grow tall. They've got quite a repertoire of ways to stick around. And so besides the wonderful fact that they are food for our dwindling bee populations, so they're also nutritious for humans should you ever need to eat them. They're quite edible, a little more tasty in the early spring. The roots can be made into coffee. So the lowly dandelion, I wish I had time for a poem about the dandelion, but I think we must be about wrapping it up. But rethink clipping those dandelions and maybe let them grow. So
I think we've got 1 minute.
You've got about a minute?
We have 1 minute. Why don't you do your poem?
Okay, the poem that I actually have picked out is about poetry. So in this case, we've had quite a lot of fun with poems on the briefly the last several weeks. And I wonder, does anyone know, did we have our poet laureate, not poet laureate, but did we have our winners for the haiku poems?
I haven't heard yet.
I don't think so, not yet.
Wait for that.
Haiku will be up through the end of May.
Okay, so wander the gardens of Mukai, open dawn to dusk every day. Here is a poem from the British poet laureate, Carol Ann Duffy. You sat on your desk, swinging your legs, reading a poem by Yeats to the bored girls, except my heart stumbled and blushed as I fell in love with the words and I saw the tree in the scratched old desk under my hands. All right. Thank you all.
Thank you. And we may be getting a foghorn in a second. Otherwise, have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
That's where we miss Michael Shook. He could do the foghorns. Lynn, I think you could do one based on your duck calls. Mm-hmm. I mean, geese calls.
Until next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. See you later.